Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I have on the line Adam Levine, who is the author of American Insecurity, Why Our Economic Fears Lead to Political Inaction. Adam's book is published in 2015 by Princeton University Press. Adam, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's such a pleasure to have read the book, and I've been looking forward to talking about it, so timely in so many ways. Before we get to what you did, why don't you tell us just a little bit about who you are?
Sure. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here. So I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell. I joined the Cornell faculty in 2011. And broadly speaking, my areas of interest concern communication and attitude change, campaigns, and how we design and think about surveys and experiments.
Yeah, and you do such interesting questions, and you explore them in such interesting ways, which is what we'll talk about. So let's look a little at the book, and it seems to me that if we've learned anything about American politics over the last several months, it is that there are a lot of people who are very angry about the present and fearful about the future. And your book focuses on economic fears, a certain type of fear. So what are the economic fears of Americans, and what are voters most worried about?
Sure. Yeah. So what we've seen, over the past, I'd say 30 to 40 years, there's an increasing trend in economic insecurity across sort of the broad middle class, and I'm using that term fairly broadly. That manifests itself in a lot of different ways. It manifests itself in terms of increasing college costs, increasing healthcare costs, increasing retirement insecurity, which itself can be linked to not having, let's say, defined benefit pension plans that used to be at least more common. Certainly not everybody had them, but they were more common. As well as increasing concerns about losing one's job involuntarily, having one's wages not increase or potentially get slashed, competition from abroad for jobs and things like that. There are also other dimensions as well, increasing childcare costs and things like that. And so what this all adds up to is a picture in which life is a lot more insecure for many, many Americans than it was, say, a generation ago. And that insecurity reflects sort of, a concern about essentially slipping off the economic ladder, slipping off of one's current position on the economic ladder.
Now, your book is also is not just about that. It's also about the variety of organizations that are worried about economic issues and how they try to address these worries through collective action.
Yeah, no, that's right.
So what are the types of organizations that you focus on in the book? What are some examples of the organizations that try to help us deal with these feelings of economic insecurity?
Yeah, so the answer to that question has changed quite a bit, let's say now relative to the middle of the 20th century and then even going further back from there. One of the things I talk about in the book is the fact that, we've seen unionization rates that have changed tremendously, certainly since the New Deal era. Whereas you used to have a much larger proportion of Americans, both in the private sector and in the public sector, who were members of unions, now that's not necessarily the case. I mean, now you have, particularly on the private sector side, you have single digits of private sector workers that are members of unions. And unions have often been linked to a variety of outcomes that make life less insecure in an economic sense for many workers, ensuring a certain degree of wages and benefits and recourse in case one's job is threatened. And so on the one hand, you have unions. On the other hand, you also have lots of other kinds of organizations that, in particular, Theda Skocpol has written a lot about. Federations that, broadly speaking, organized and brought together people from the sort of broad middle class and working class throughout the 20th century that just aren't maybe quite as active anymore. They have organizations like, and when I say not as active, what I mean is that their membership is not nearly as large. And so some of them would be organizations like the American Legion or maybe the Elks or the Moose, organizations like that. And so now what we're seeing, and one of the things I talk about in the book a lot, is, if we're going to think about sort of what political mobilization around, say, economic insecurity, broadly shared economic insecurity-related issues might be, one way to really sort of think about that is in terms of groups that are, you know, more commonly referred to as, say, like single issue sorts of groups, or if not single issue, maybe broad issue, but not geographically specific, and certainly not tied to one's labor force status. And so, like, for example, MoveOn.org would be an example. So they're not single issue, but they're also not membership in MoveOn.org is by no means tied to one's occupation or, you know, labor force status or anything like that. And there are a lot of other organizations like that as well. In the book, I talk about, so for example, in the push for healthcare reform in 2008, 2009, to 2010, there was an organization called HCAN, Healthcare for America Now. And it was, you know, basically the most prominent and largest coalition of organizations on the progressive side that was pushing for healthcare reform. And they, so in this case, again, unlike MoveOn.org, they were pretty much single issue. And they were trying to organize a broad coalition of citizens across the United States to help sort of, you know, keep Congress's feet to the fire, try to make sure that healthcare reform gets done.
Now, we've all watched political ads by one of these groups, probably more than one of these groups, or received an email asking for our support. You argue that each of us will respond differently to these communications. How is this a case? And maybe you could talk a little bit about your working theory about how mobilization works, or more importantly, doesn't work.
Sure. Yeah. So what the book starts with is sort of, you know, and this is slightly on the academic side of things, but as I talk about it, I think it would resonate with a much broader audience because it resonates with sort of, you know, the kinds of experiences that I think many of us have or we know people who have had. You know, there's a lot of factors that go into whether or not people sort of become engaged in politics. And by becoming engaged, that can mean lots of different things. That can mean paying attention to politics. That can mean donating money to a political organization or a candidate that you support. It can mean volunteering with an organization. It can mean, you know, joining an email listserv, a whole host of possible outcomes, both attitudinal and behavioral. And there's a lot of things we know about sort of the kinds of factors that lead people to become engaged. And so caring about issues is a really big factor. Having personal experience with certain kinds of issue concerns, that's a big factor. We know that people who simply have more on an objective level, have more time or money, are more likely to become politically active. And we also know, for example, that, you know, people rarely become politically active sort of on their own without sort of essentially an organization or a friend or somebody sort of coming to them and saying, hey, you know, we think that, you know, this is an important issue and we're wondering if you'd like to sort of, you know, join us and become active on the cause. And so, you know, you have sort of this like wide range of both organizational as well as individual level attributes that are thought to be really important to getting people engaged. With the book starts by talking about all of that. And acknowledging all of that, because I think all of that is important and in a very big way. But I think that there's another sort of set of barriers to getting people engaged that hasn't really sort of been elucidated as much as it ought to be, and I think it's really important, especially in the world of economic, particularly with the politics of economic insecurity, though actually in the politics of other issues as well. And these are kind of what I refer to in the book as communicative barriers. And what I mean by that is the idea that sort of, you know, most people don't walk around with a specific idea as to whether or not they would or would not get involved in politics or would or would not become active on an issue at any particular moment. Those decisions are taken in the moment when they're presented with the decision. So when an organization actually reaches out to them and says, hey, you know, would you be willing to donate money or donate time to our organization and help the cause? It's at that moment that people think about it. And so the information that becomes salient to them, the kinds of considerations that are made salient in that request, can actually have a really big impact. And that's sort of one of the most, arguably one of the most fundamental things that come out of decades of research on political communication, is that the kinds of ideas and considerations made salient in that moment can have a really big impact. And so how does this all link up to economic insecurity? Well, the thing that I worry a lot about in the book, and I think what is arguably the sort of, you know, kind of what I would say is sort of the newest sort of insight in thinking about communicative barriers to political engagement, is the fact that when we try to mobilize people around forms of economic insecurity, financial constraints that they're facing, you know, at some like very sort of fundamental level, what we're doing is we're reminding them about financial constraints that they're facing. And it turns out that when you remind people about financial constraints that they're facing and then ask them to spend money or time on politics, they're often less willing to do so. It's basically, if you want to put it crudely, you're telling people they're poor, but then still asking them to spend time or money. And that can be a hard sell.
Yeah, it's just such an interesting and somewhat, when you get to it, it's not as counterintuitive as it might look. But I think it's so interesting. And you go beyond just simply presenting this theory. You test it with a series of experiments. Would you walk us through how one of those experiments was designed? And then what you actually found? Is this theory, in fact, true in the experiment that you did?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to talk about it. So there's a number of different experiments, as well as a number of different public opinion studies and some other survey data in the book, to try to really kind of, you know, flesh out sort of what this would look like. You know, the experiments are exciting in a way because some of them, at least, are done in the field, in which I partnered with real organizations that are interested in knowing about some of the stuff that I'm talking about. Like, on the one hand, they're very interested in sort of making sure in potentially mobilizing people around various forms of economic insecurity that they're facing. And one of the things I should really sort of say is that, you know, this is by no means a partisan issue. When you look at the data, the public opinion data on, you know, should the government be involved in trying to, at some broad level, or actually not at some broad level, at very specific levels on specific issues, make life more secure or make sure that there are economic opportunities for people and that, you know, health emergencies and not being able to afford college, like, don't stand in the way. There's very broad bipartisan support for that kind of stuff. And so at a very sort of basic level, just in terms of like the public opinion landscape, there's actually, there's far more of a consensus across partisan lines than I think one might imagine, given some of the political rhetoric that we hear, especially during the campaign. But setting that aside for a second, or I should say, not so much setting aside as much as building on it. When I partner with organizations and that are interested in sort of, you know, trying to, say, for example, address healthcare costs, what we've done is we've done, you know, fairly, at some level, fairly simple experiments where we, you know, have a, where we take a group of people that, let's say, are not currently members of the organization, and we randomly assign them to receive different kinds of solicitations that are related to, in one of the cases, for example, related to the cost of healthcare. And so in one case, it would be an organization. This was a 501c3, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, and that does, among other things, does a lot of different things, but one of the things that it does is it engages in voter education campaigns. And the voter education campaigns, they are not explicit. They're certainly not partisan. They're not even really political per se. They're really just sort of saying, you know, these are changes that are being made to policies, and this is how they might affect you. And in this case in particular, this is how they might affect your health care and your health insurance. And so what we did is we randomly assigned people to receive either a letter in the mail, piece of direct mail, that said, you know, this is the organization. And this is, broadly speaking, kind of what the organization does. And then another set of people were randomly assigned to get exactly that same message, but with an added paragraph that talked about the skyrocketing cost of healthcare. And you know, and all of that was, you know, completely real and factual information that had come from very well-documented sources. And that was information that arguably was very important to the people who were receiving our solicitation. And that's sort of the interesting thing. That sort of, you know, what we're doing here is we're mentioning information about the skyrocketing cost of healthcare that ought to be very important to people. And according to surveys, it is very important to people. And what we found is that actually people's willingness to donate money to this organization, the 501c3 organization, actually was lower when we presented the information about healthcare costs than in the letter that did not mention healthcare costs at all. And so it's just, so on the one hand, you're mentioning information, refers to issues that people care about, they consider to be really important, it touches their daily lives, it's kitchen table issues all around, and actually is reducing their willingness to spend money, i.e. making them less likely to become politically engaged.
Now, what does this mean for an interest group or a civic organization? What does it mean for what they should do to mobilize their supporters? What do you do if you're trying to address issues of economic insecurity? Do you not mention that, or do you mention them in other ways? What is the What are one of the takeaways from what you find, the recommendation that you would make to a civic organization that was working on these issues? I would imagine they would say, if we can't mention the issue, how are we even going to talk about it? So what do you recommend?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of different things to come out of this, and things that I certainly talk about a bit in the conclusion. Though actually, in retrospect, wish I even talked more about in the concluding chapter of the book. So one is, I'm going to start with sort of the, there's two major ones. One is that the people who are demobilized are the people who care about the issues, but yet are personally affected. And so if you have a set of people that care about the issues but aren't personally affected, for example, in the healthcare case, that might be people who, care about healthcare costs and skyrocketing healthcare costs, maybe because of, family members who are other kinds of family members who are experiencing them, friends, because of ideological commitments, whatever it is. They care about it, but they're not personally affected. Maybe because they have really good health insurance, they themselves are in good health, whatever it is. They can actually be mobilized, and they can be mobilized for the same reason that psychologists and political scientists have known that they can be mobilized for decades, which is basically that they care about the issues, and so you're talking about something that they care about, and that can be really impactful. Now, the potential sort of downside with that comes in with, that's at some level, from a representational lens, that's a little bit of like, a surrogate representation or surrogacy in terms of representation, because you're basically sort of, depending upon other people to essentially have the voice and keeping, say, for example, Congress's feet to the fire, or the interest group leaders' feet to the fire, on these issues. And those people who care about the issues, may have slightly different preferences in terms of, say, what should be done about them. And we know that to be the case, for example, in healthcare, that, people who are less likely to be personally affected by healthcare costs, even if they care about the issue, they also tend to be far more likely to support private solutions, let's say, relative to government solutions. So, so we need to be thinking seriously about that from the representational side. And that also might not sound very concrete to an interest group leader. I mean, I'll fully admit. But here's something that I think would sound more concrete to an interest group leader, and something that I don't have any evidence on this in the book, and so this is slightly speculation, but it's speculation that I think is informed by what we know about political engagement and civic engagement more generally in other contexts. And this is, note how everything I've been talking about really cuts against this idea that people who find issues to be important are going to be more likely to act on them. So issue importance is essentially a motivational element in trying to explain and stimulate political engagement. But there's other motivations that people have for getting politically active. And so one, for example, is for lack of a better term, social pressure or social influences, where, let's say, a good friend or a family member or, somebody that that you really care about comes to you and says, I'm involved in something, and I would really love you to join me. And so there's other sorts of motivations that can sort of, that can become really important at moments like that. And so the key thing, and one of the major sort of takeaways that I hope people take away from the book, at least, is that I would never claim that mobilization around economic and security issues is impossible. That sort of historically is not true, and I don't think it's true. Empirically, I don't think it's true. But I think what it is, important to recognize is that there's this extra barrier to action that is based on the communication, this communicative barrier to action that a lot of other issues just don't face, because other issues just don't remind people about financial security.
Such an interesting book. Again, the title is American Insecurity: Why Our Economic Fears Lead to Political Inaction. The author is Adam Levine. The publisher is Princeton University Press. Adam, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you very much.